Blueprint here on RN. Next, a small composition for Entwistle and Tree in the key of C.
I'm with Martin Friedel, who's a scientist, composer, and not so much a tree whisperer as perhaps a tree listener, a creator of scores for 50 films, 6 chamber operas, many installations, hundreds of compositions. But today I want to talk to you about listening to trees. And you're here in the Botanic Gardens because you've got in mind a project to get not only yourself listening to trees, but everyone else as well.
Yes, trees are, the more I look at trees and listen to them and spend time with them, the more amazing they turn out to be. We think of them as sort of inert, static, just there really as a presence rather than as the sort of amazing living thing, because I guess it's their slowness. And so when I've put a microphone, special microphone, to a tree, I suddenly listen to all of this noise and sound and whatever that's going on inside them, which is quite lively, in fact, and seems to contradict our notion of what trees are.
So when you're listening, though, these are presumably, at least some of them, are mechanical sounds and creakings, or is it more than that, though? Is it more than just the tree's physical shape making those noises?
I record two things. The first is the audio of the tree, the actual sound, but I also record the electrical impulses of the trees through the leaves, through attaching little sensitive pads to the trees, like the ones that you get put on your head when you go in for a brain scan. And those electrical signals are also quite lively, and I convert those into music so that you can get a piano piece that sounds very like a 20th century contemporary master, and it's your local gum tree doing it.
Well, tell me a bit more about that. So the electrical impulses, there's something going on in a leaf.
Yes.
And you somehow get that mesh. So why does the leaf have electrical impulses or differences in it?
Well, it's to do, I believe, with photosynthesis and electron transport and all very complex things, potential differences. So these then generate small fluctuations in the voltage that I measure. And then that's converted through a little electronic box into MIDI music instrument digital interface. And then I can play it through synthesizers. And it's quite amazing to hear some of this music. And it seems to be that there are differences. If I put the same electrodes to my head and listen to what comes out of it, it's quite different to what the tree does.
Okay, and do different trees have different sounds, different leaf shapes, for example?
Yes, they do. I'm not quite sure how distinct this is, whether it's just individual differences or whether there are class differences, so that all blue gums have a distinctive sound as opposed to manna gums or stringy barks. But there are differences.
Yeah, and presumably there's sort of Beethovens out there in the plant world and people like myself.
Yes, but you could say perhaps there are Einsteins there too and Galileos amongst the tree world.
Well, that brings us to the other sounds you're recording. So if you're listening to a trunk, for example, and it's the sound of things moving around a tree, and I presume there's sap in there, that's one thing.
Yes.
What other things might be going on inside a tree?
Well, I've had papers sent to me by people who understand tree mechanics, and they say that the tree is structured with its branch and trunk structure in such a way as to maximize the dissipation of energy the tree receives in, say, a storm. Because if it didn't get rid of this energy somehow, it would just fall down or break. So it gets rid of it by waving its branches around in certain complex mathematical ways, in harmonic ways. And that some of the sounds that I hear are due to that. Somebody else suggested when we stand still, we constantly control our own balance in order to stay upright, and perhaps trees do the same in small ways, that there are stresses and tension in the root system. However it is, the sounds, the cracks and so on, are sort of mechanical noises and produced perhaps by the branches hitting together. Some of them you can hear by just putting your ear to the tree, they're the obvious ones, by leaves rustling further up. But in some cases, the sounds mean something that people can interpret. For example, the movement of sap sounds are now being used to measure stress in trees, apparently. And there's a number of scientific papers that I've spotted deal with this.
And you mentioned putting your ear to a tree. Has that been, do you think people have actually used that perhaps today or in the past to interpret what's going on around them and what's going on at the top of the tree?
I think the tree, from what I can listen to, because I can hear birds in the canopy, which I can't hear from in the ground with ground microphones, that they act like the doctor's stethoscope in some way, that they bring the sound down and feed it directly into the ear. So I would have thought that hunters here and elsewhere would have made use of that, given that their ears were much better than ours.
In fact, that brings us to an exhibition or something you've been working on just recently at the Melbourne Museum, and you've been working with local Aboriginal communities, or particularly an elder in central Victoria, to record sounds from scar trees. And did that bring out any sort of cultural links through that recording?
Oh, yes. I mean, the scar trees are very significant. They're up in the Wimmera, and in a way, they're both sacred objects. They're archaeological relics, because some of the scars predate white settlement, for example, and the trees themselves were mature when the scars were done, when the bark was removed. So the trees might be 200 or 300, 400 years older than the actual scars. And so there's a whole collection of them, and they have a enormous significance to the local people.
And the soundscape you've done for that, and I have listened to this at the museum, is a series of recordings you've done from those same trees?
Yes, from those trees. And I've interwoven just bird sounds and wind sounds within that, just all from the local landscape, because in a way there's a sort of a unity between, I guess, what the trees do and what happens around outside them. The Wimmera tree landscape is very sparse in terms of trees. Trees are far apart. They're very old. They're very individual. And so it's a landscape that is both stretches out for a long way, so it's quite sparse. And somehow the sound of the trees and what I hear around them captures that landscape. So the audio, the sound, or the music of the landscape is reflected in the music of the trees.
And with that recording you have words, I think it's poems read by Uncle Jim Bird.
That's right. He reflects upon both his own feelings towards this landscape, as well as the actual landscape and the importance of the scar trees, and in a sense a reminder for us to treat these with respect and to look after them.
I said at the start you've done multiple compositions, worked in music for a very long time, but you did start as a scientist. So I'm intrigued a little bit about that transition, and have you sort of done a circle back to that, or has that always been part of your music as well?
I went to a country high school and we had a fabulous science teacher, and so my mother was quite a good pianist, but somehow the science was more interesting than that. But then when I went to university, I did physics and maths, and then I suddenly became interested in music again. And so I brushed up my music and auditioned and got into the conservatory and found a teacher and continued there while I was doing postgraduate science. And there were a lot of people in my class who did the same. A lot of mathematicians seemed to play musical instruments. Anyway, I got to the end of that, and then I met somebody who was playing in the La Mama Theatre, and I was asked to play piano for that. And having been through that, I couldn't go back to the laboratory.
what part of it was the attraction?
Well, you've worked in laboratories at a much higher level than I have, but there is a certain, I wouldn't say monotony, but there's a certain repetitive nature of it. And I found out that...
I should point out here that says the man who's recording trees with low murmurs going on for probably many hours. But
I'm allowed to contradict myself on this point. Patience in music is a virtue too, of course. But and so I got involved in that. And once you step off the science train and you don't publish anymore and so on, then that comes to an end. But I've always remained interested in science, and I'm interested in science even though I don't want to be a scientist. I think those two things are not contradictory. So I've read and kept up, and my older brother was an entomologist, and my father was sort of engineering type of person, but I was pulled to the music side of the family, so I continued with that. And at one stage I realised I had to earn a living from it, so I looked to earn a living from it, so that's brought me to here. But the science, for some reason, seems to be coming back much stronger now than it has been for a few years, for a long time, and I've become really fascinated by all of this. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, I suppose.
Yeah, look, I do like the idea of a scientifically literate world, if you like, musicians. And I think sometimes science is seen as boxed off and kept in a laboratory and something you have to be a scientist to do. So I think it is, you know, bring it into music, bring it into other parts of life. It's fascinating, which I wanted to also make sure I talked to you about a composition you've done called Dance with the Bees, which you describe as an interspecies collaboration, which I love. I love the sound of that. Maybe you could explain that one.
Well, Dance of the Bee was conceived because I've kept bees for about 30 or 40 years, wherever I've lived, in backyards, in my block up in the Strathbogies. I live next to a park and I get the occasional swarm there in spring, and I catch them and give them to friends who are interested in keeping bees and so on. And I've got the bees outside my studio window on a warm day. You can hear the hum. And I go to the piano and I strike middle C, and they're around about middle C, which I call the middle C of contentment. It's on a nice warm day and the bees are flying. And so I used this sound, and I found out that because I listened to it, and when you keep bees, you learn to listen to sound. When you open the hive, what happens to that sound? If it starts getting high-pitched, you know that maybe they're going to be a little bit edgy. But if it continues at this sort of middle C buzz, you know that they're happy and they don't mind being interfered with just a little bit. And then there's, of course, the extraordinary dance of the bee, which is this mathematically precise description of where to go. It's like an orientation map. And then, so I got in touch with bee cognition people here in overseas and in the US. And everything I learned filled me with amazement about these tiny animals, that somehow we've underestimated their abilities all along. We think that they're just some sort of mechanical little device in a way, which they're not. In fact, one of the researchers told me that she thought that they might have individual behaviours, which goes against everything that even beekeepers have learnt about bees.
I can see a slight similarity with a musician, because if you were external to humans or from outer space, perhaps, and you looked at a musician, you'd say they're just doing a very mechanical process.
Yes.
This is just one note after another.
Yes.
Perhaps we look at bees the same way too.
Yes, and there's no doubt that, I use the beehive as a metaphor for music, and I explore, with the help of three pianos and four pianists and a choir, this notion. But we had the bees on stage as part of the performance. I built a little transparent box for them and brought them into the performing space and put lights on them and attached microphones and video cameras so that people could watch and listen to the bees. And their sound mingled with that of the hive in a rather beautiful way, I thought.
And it's okay to work with bees, you know, the advice about animals and children?
The place where we did the performance, I was slightly nervous from a occupational health and safety aspect, but I explained that if for some reason the hive was broken, and I said it was made out of stuff that they made riot shields of, so that was unlikely, but if they did, they would all fly up to where the lights were hanging from the ceiling so everybody could get out fine.
Thank you. Martin Friedel, a beautiful mix of and music from science and from nature. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Tim Entwistle with Martin Friedel and that exhibition, Silent Witness. That's on at the Melbourne Museum if you're passing through until June. We'll pop a link up on the blueprint page of the RN website.